Exodus chapter 2. So we began a new series, now going through the book of Exodus. So this is message number 3 in that series entitled Out of Egypt. And we'll be looking at chapter 2 in this message, and I want to begin with verses 1 to 4. And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could not longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done to him. Well, the code of Ur-Nammu from Mesopotamia in the 21st century B.C. is the oldest known law code from history, and it included a number of laws in it relevant to slaves, including the bounty for the return of runaway slaves. Ultimately, that code recognized two social classes, those that were free and those who were slaves. The Babylonian Code of Hammurabi, which is one people are a little more familiar with, from the 18th century B.C., is very similar with its laws relative to slaves. And of course, slavery is mentioned quite a bit in the Bible. The Old Covenant had various laws relative to slaves and, of course, prohibited the chattel type of slavery that we often associate with that term. But the practice itself serves to furnish one of the pictures that we get from the Bible of mankind's natural condition, born in slavery to sin, unable to free himself, unable to liberate himself, and in need of redemption. Well, slaves in the ancient world would come from various different sources. Many of them would oftentimes be prisoners of war that would be put into service into the conquering nation. Sometimes it would be the poor who voluntarily sold themselves into slavery because they simply could not make their living otherwise. Sometimes it would be debtors, those that would be sort of pressed into service because they were unable to pay their debts, and they might, after a time, be able to actually, you know, work that off and to be freed. And of course, there was always some slaves who were foreigners, not from that nation. Usually, these would be bought from sellers, and sellers oftentimes would kidnap various people of sometimes of their own, sometimes of other nations, and would sell them, and these would be bought for slaves. You also would have generational slaves, those that were born into it, unable to obtain freedom. Sometimes when a people would be conquered, they would be subjugated. Sometimes there would be oppressed people that would be subjugated, which was the case with Israel in Egypt. So what I'm saying is that slavery is a very old practice in the world and throughout history, and it is known to have been present long before even this incident in Egypt. Now, slavery, of course, was only one form of suffering and atrocities in the ancient world. We could also look back on aspects of tortures and human sacrifice and ethnic cleansings and various things that have taken place throughout history. And so that really should bring us to a question as we are in these early part of Exodus. With all of the suffering peoples in antiquity, in all the suffering nations, and all the things that people were subjected to, why did God intervene at this point in history? And why did God intervene with this people group from Jacob? In other words, why not other peoples? Why not at other times? Well, Exodus chapter 2 actually gives us an important answer to that question. Chapter 1 that we looked at last time opens up the book of Exodus with a big picture view of the settling with Israel in Egypt. Once the patriarchs are gone and all that original generation that came into Egypt are gone, we notice that chapter 1 doesn't really focus on particular people. The exception is, of course, the two Hebrew midwives that are mentioned toward the end of the chapter. But we saw in chapter 1 how that Israel grew into a family. They grew into a people group. And Egypt's government changed regimes, and suddenly Israel was considered a problem that was needing a solution, which is not at all uncommon in the history of that nation. So chapter 1 gave us three plans from the Pharaoh to mitigate the threat of Israel. Their population growth rate was extraordinary. It was beyond normal. In other words, showing that there was some sort of supernatural intervention that was indeed taking place. So they thought that pressing them into hard bondage would slow that down. The growth of the nation was obviously also very vulnerable at times of the birth of the males, and so the midwives could easily kill them at that point and get control on the population of Israel. And then, of course, the male babies that had been born to the Jews could also be eliminated by throwing them into the Nile River. Now, Moses notes for us in chapter 1 that not only did these policies fail, they were effective in the sense that Israel did become an enslaved people group, but the result or the aim for that was not met. But they also, these policies had the opposite result from what was intended, and Israel only grew more. And of course, all this growth was the result of God's blessings through keeping His covenant promises. Now in chapter 2, Moses zooms in and he looks at one family in Israel and ultimately at one man, Moses himself. So this chapter brings out the need for deliverance for Israel. And it shows that that deliverance will come through God's faithfulness to remember His covenant. In verses 1 to 10, we see where Moses is drawn out of the water. And in verses 11 to 24, where Moses actually flees and leaves Egypt. So we're going to start here in the first part in verses 1 to 10 with Moses being drawn out of the water. Let's read the first four verses again. And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could not longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein. And she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done to him. So the account moves along. As Israel has become enslaved and the Pharaoh has enacted these various policies. And Moses zooms in here on a Levite man and a Levite woman that he married. Now, they are later identified in chapter 6 and verse number 20. His father's name was Amram. His mother's name was Jochebed. And the stress here is on this tribal lineage. He was a man of Levi and a woman of Levi that married. This tribal lineage indicates that Israel's identity as a people group and as a nation had been preserved. It actually was intact. And we previously noted how that actually some of the existing prejudices in Egypt toward the shepherd peoples and way of life with Israel, as well as some of these later problems with them being enslaved and their separation. All these things actually served their population growth and their development into a nation. It's very easy. Oftentimes the nation that would be conquered would be scattered among that conquering nation and ultimately would sort of melt and blend in and would lose their identity as a nation. But that did not happen with Israel. And on the one hand, you look at the suffering that they endured, but yet you see also that even through that, their identity as a nation was preserved and God's promises were fulfilled. So these two Levites had a son who is noted here as being extraordinarily beautiful. And the writer of Hebrews actually echoes that. They saw something very exceptional about this baby boy. That's Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 23. And the writer there also notes that their actions to hide and to save this child were actions of faith. And that means that they acted having hope in God's promises. They didn't have any instructions about what to do in this circumstance that they were in. They got to the point that they could no longer hide the baby and they've got to do something. Well, they didn't have any specific instructions for what to do in this case, but they acted in faith, meaning that they believed. They believed the Lord. They believed His promises. They had hope in His promises and they trusted and looked to Him for salvation. And Stephen also comments on this in his message before the council there in Acts chapter 7 and verse number 20. And again, all these different references point out that, you know, this baby boy was really something extraordinary about him that his parents recognized. Well, when hiding the baby was no longer going to work, we're told how that Moses' mother carefully constructed this little ark and ensuring that it would float. And so when you think about it, she technically followed Pharaoh's command and put the baby boy in the river, just as had been commanded, though one would have to say probably not in the way that he envisioned. Moses' sister is also later identified as her name as Miriam in chapter 15 and verse number 20. So the whole scene that we're given here that starts out this chapter is a scene that speaks of faith and expectation. This isn't an act of desperation. This isn't an act of giving up. This isn't an act of just yielding and surrendering. But these are acts of faith because there is hope and expectation. Now the tension is built up here with Miriam that she watched to see what would happen. So we know that they had hope in the actions that they took. Verse number 5. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. Now, the narrative does not suggest to us that this coincidence, so to speak, was the master plan of Moses' mother. In other words, we see her actions. We're not told that this was her strategy to have happen. But rather, when we read this account through the eyes of faith, what we recognize is what we oftentimes refer to as God's providence, that unseen hand that is working in events, more behind the scenes rather than sort of an outward intervention. The princess of Egypt, the daughter of Pharaoh, came down to the river and she saw this little ark and sent her servant, we're told. Verses 6 to 9. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept, and she had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for thee?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, "Take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages." And the woman took the child and nursed it. So she saw the baby. She heard him crying, and we're told that she was moved to pity the child. In other words, her inclination was to save this child, even though she recognized that it was a Hebrew male baby. And there had been a decree given by the Pharaoh that all of them were to be cast into the river. But she didn't do that. She didn't follow the decree. She was moved with pity to save the child alive. Now, we come back to thinking about Miriam that was watching what would happen, watching as this scene unfolds, and she seizes this opportunity to suggest going and getting a nurse, and she ultimately brings back Moses' mother. And then, of course, in a very interesting turn of events in this whole scene, this daughter of Pharaoh actually hires Moses' mother to nurse her own son until that he was weaned, at which point the Pharaoh's daughter would adopt him. And that's what we read about in verse number 10. And the child grew, and she brought unto him Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, "Because I drew him out of the water." So Moses, as the baby grew, and ultimately he was brought, returned to the Pharaoh's daughter, and she adopted him as her son. And there's significance to that title. That title brought a certain amount of privilege to Moses. It was a position that he was brought into the very household of Pharaoh. Now, of course, the writer of Hebrews noted how that Moses never indulged that privilege. Moses never clung to that. Moses continued to identify with the Hebrews, with his people, the people of Israel. And of course, we're told here how that he was named Moses and why, because he was drawn out of the water, which is what the name indicates. Now, we get to the next part as the account is continuing to give us this setup to get into the actual events of the Exodus. So verse number 11 and 12, "And it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way, and when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand." So you notice how that the account skips forward, leaving out many of the details of Moses' childhood and his education, his rearing and his upbringing in the Pharaoh's household. And certainly those would all be things that we would be interested in knowing, but those are not the important events. So the first of two key events happens here that leads to Moses actually leaving Egypt as a fugitive. He saw one of his own people, one of his kinsmen according to the flesh, one of the people of Israel, being beaten by an Egyptian. Now, this reminds us again of the suffering condition of Israel in Egypt. As you're reading along the story, it almost seems like, well, we have the classic rags-to-riches story. I mean, Moses is born to this enslaved and oppressed people. Life is in danger, but it is spared by the princess of Egypt, and ultimately he's adopted and raised in Pharaoh's house to essentially become a prince of Egypt and all of these sort of things, and sounds like he's really got it made. That, of course, is not the way that this story goes. Israel was still in a suffering condition. And the indication here that this Egyptian is beating this Hebrew and likely in danger of killing him. And so Moses takes action. He kills this Egyptian and buries him. Now, Moses is presented to us here as a man of action and a man of conviction, though certainly not condoning the action that he takes. But his action does set up the next scene. So, verses 13 to 15. "And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together. And he said to him that did the wrong, 'Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow?' And he said, Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, Surely this thing is known. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. So the next day, Moses sees two of the men of Israel that are fighting with each other. And notice how that this is put in verse 13. Moses questioned the one that did the wrong. In other words, Moses was addressing the offender and his actions as being unjust. And it helps us to understand why that he responded the way that he did when he said, asked Moses essentially the question of his authority. Who are you, Moses? I mean, who has made you a prince over Israel? Who has made you a judge among the people of Israel? Who gave you the right? Who gave you the authority to question or to judge between us? Now, this question of authority and this question of the right to act and to command continues, actually, as what we refer to as a motif throughout the book of Exodus. But here, this question actually highlights the fact that Moses had neither. He had no position among the people of Israel. Yes, he had been adopted as a son in Pharaoh's house, which offered him a position in Egypt, but he had no standing among the people of Israel. He had not yet been called by God. He had not yet been put into any sort of a position of leadership or any sort of a position of authority. And then, of course, the question comes, are you going to kill me like you did the Egyptian? Letting Moses know that his actions were known, even though that he thought that they were hidden. And then we find out that the story reaches all the way to Pharaoh about what Moses has done, and he wanted Moses executed. So he had to flee from Egypt and from his people. So Moses essentially becomes an exile. He becomes an exile from a land and a people that wasn't his own to begin with. So he comes to sit down by a well. And at this point, if you're familiar with the accounts in Genesis and you're reading forward, we start to notice that there's some familiarity. There's the events in Moses' life is beginning to echo in some ways the lives of the patriarchs before him. Now, that doesn't mean that Moses was trying to effect this parallel in his own life. And it is an important point for us to understand of what it means to live by faith. Rather, what we have here is emphasizing God's working in Moses' life, guiding his life. Though he hadn't yet appeared to Moses, he hadn't defined the calling on Moses' life. Let's look at verses 16 to 19. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, How is it that ye are come so soon today? And they said, An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock. So Moses now is giving us a little bit of editorial exposition here in verse 16 about the priest of Midian. Later we find out his name is also Jethro. He had seven daughters and they came, I'm sure, commonly to water the flock at this well that Moses had happened to sit down by. Now, remember that the Midianites were descendants from Abraham and his second wife, Keturah, whom he married after that Sarah died. That's back in Genesis chapter 25 and verses 1 to 4, meaning that the Midianites were not heirs of the covenant. The local shepherds drove these daughters of Jethro away, and again, Moses acted. And notice the wording that is used. He stood up, and he saved them, which the word means saved or delivered. He drew water for them. So this part of the account actually has some foreshadowing of Israel's deliverance through Moses that's going to come a little later. But the name of this man was also Reuel, which means something like friend of God. And he may have worshipped the God of Abraham. We don't know. He wondered at how they finished watering the flocks so quickly. And so the explanation was given that there was an Egyptian that had saved them from the shepherds and drew water for them. Of course, they mistakenly thought Moses was an Egyptian, and that's certainly how he must have looked. Verses 20 to 22. And he said unto his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that ye have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah his daughter, and she bare him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a strange land." So he sends the daughters to call for Moses that he may eat with them, and Moses stays on with the family. Jethro ends up giving his daughter to Moses to marry. Moses had a son of his own, giving him a name that signifies his status as a stranger in a strange land. So obviously there's sort of a summary here as a lot of time is going by. And in verses 23 to 25, give us a significant ending to this chapter. And it came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. And the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. Now, back in chapter 1, Israel's troubles really began with a new king. And now the death of a king means another new king, but it also signals here another change. In fact, this is sort of the beginning of their deliverance. Their long bondage had brought out their cries and their groaning. So again, for all the things that have happened with Moses, the people of Israel are still enslaved and they are still afflicted with a very bitter and hard bondage. But God heard and God remembered. And we get these various action verbs concerning God. He heard, he remembered, he saw, he knew. So now, here we have an explanation of the timing of God's actions. Why did God act when he did, and why with this people? Again, at any given time, throughout history, various atrocities and cruelties and terrible things and suffering and all these things are happening. And so why does God act here at this time and with this people? Well, the answer is very simple. It's because of his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And so this question of why now and why Israel is answered in terms of God's covenant promises. God promised to bring them out. God gave them the land of promise. And this is actually, this covenant and this promise is actually referred to much, much later as being the grounds of Israel's hope. So here's a couple of passages. Micah chapter 7, verses 19 to 20. He will turn again, speaking of God. He will have compassion upon us, speaking of Israel. He will subdue our iniquities, and thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. Thou wilt perform the truth to Jacob and the mercy to Abraham, which thou hast sworn unto our fathers from the days of old. So no matter how bad the condition of Israel is, no matter how bleak the outlook may be, the grounds of their hope always comes back to these promises to the fathers. And even in the New Testament, when the angel appeared to Mary and foretold of the birth of Jesus, it's put in these terms in Luke chapter 1, verses 54 and 55. He hath hope in his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, as he spake to our fathers, to Abraham and to his seed forever, referencing again these covenant promises. And so this chapter ends saying that God saw and God knew Israel. And these words indicate that God will act And he will act because of his covenant, which is secured by his very name, which becomes important in the next chapter. So the book of Exodus is typically known as a book with extraordinary intervening acts by God. But this chapter is really more full of providential irony and happenings. We've seen Pharaoh gives a decree for the male babies to be thrown into the Nile, and so Moses is put into the Nile. But then it's Pharaoh's own daughter that found the baby and recognized him as being one of the Hebrews, but out of pity saved him. She hires a nursemaid for the child, which is Moses' mother, and ultimately she is paid to wean her own son. Now the writer of Hebrews noted the acts of faith in this story, and the discerning reader should recognize the hand of God throughout. And it might seem like that Moses' mother was relying on some sort of non-distinct fate or some sort of chance in the universe for her son, but she was trusting in God, whose blessings were evident despite their hardship and whose promises were made sure by his own name. So this chapter also makes the need for deliverance obvious and answers that need with God hearing Israel and remembering his covenant. So when we read what happened over 3,000 years ago, it does inform us today. Living faith is believing God and basing one's life on his word. Not circumstances, not trying to sort of discern the direction of the wind and, well, I think God's doing this, I think God's going that way, and trying, but rather following his word and trusting in him. And we could say that there's a certain way of misreading the Bible that might conclude that waiting at a well is the way to find a spouse, because it worked for Moses and Jacob and Isaac and so many others.